We're about to start Perek Tes Vav of Sefer Shmuel Aleph, which really is in many ways the most important parak of the whole Sefer, because that is where Shaul fights Amalek. And this time we could talk about for hours and hours and hours Amalek in general, the mitzvah to wipe out Amalek, what exactly is the mitzvah, the ethical component to it. We're going to be limited. But I think the best way to attack it is before we dive into the text of the parak, which will definitely take us a week or two because there's a lot going on. I think it's a topic which really is worth us taking a week to look at Amalek more generally, do some overview, introduction to the topic of who Amalek is, what Amalek stands for. And once we have that in the bag, that'll be a lot more helpful for delving into the psukim and seeing where exactly Shaul fails. Because this is going to be Shaul's dramatic failure. I mean, this is, we've already seen we've seen Shaul fail once, and we've seen Shmuel realize that he's not cut out for the kingship. But this is going to be the moment where Hashem is going to come to Shmuel and tell him that he regrets hiring the guy as king. And Shmuel's going to stay up all night davening, and it's not going to work out. So in order for us to understand why this was such a dramatic failure and why this, uniquely undermined Shaul's mission, we just need to fill in our understanding of what Amalek is all about. So I guess, just to start it off, when we think of Shaul's main enemy in Sefer Shmuel, so I think normally we think of the Plishtim, right? That's definitely the main military threat. That's who Shaul just spent the last two prakim fighting against. When Bnei Yisrael wanted a king, they wanted a king to help save them from the Plishtim, who we saw had so thoroughly penetrated the country that they couldn't even open up a iron forge to farm their fields. They've been totally overrun by the Plishtim. That's the dominant threat. And who kills Shaul in the end? The Plishtim, right? At the battle at Har Gilboa. We'll get to it at the end of Sefer Shmuel Aleph. The truth is, though, that the way the Navi sets up Sefer Shmuel, the way it's structured, the Navi actually reveals that the primary enemy of Shaul is actually Amalek. How do we see that? Well, at the end of Shmuel Aleph, we're going to have a bifurcation. We're going to have Shaul dying on Har Gilboa. And what's happening at the same time in Perek Lamed of Shmuel Aleph is going to be that while Shaul is fighting and dying, David is also fighting, but David is fighting against Amalek. And in Perek Lamed, David actually really almost fulfills the mitzvah of wiping out Amalek, because David is going to chase after this huge army of this huge roving band of Amalekim who raided where he was staying, burned the town, took all the women and children captive. David is going to chase after them. We'll see when we get there how it's going to be such an antithesis to Shaul's behavior. But the point is that Sefer Shmuel Aleph, it's not one Sefer, right? Shaul's career ends where at the moment that his rival and his foil, David, is wiping out Amalek. And the Navi says that at the end of the battle, there were just a few hundred Amalekim who were able to barely escape on Camelback, I think. But everyone else was wiped out. David is wiping Amalek out, doing the job that Shaul was supposed to do. At the same time, Shaul is dying, and we find out in Sefer Shmuel Beis, at least the person who's taking credit for killing Shaul is someone from Amalek. So you have David wiping out Amalek while Shaul, at least, as per his own report, is being killed by someone from Amalek. Amalek, actually, surprisingly, because from a military perspective, they're one of the weakest countries all around. They don't have a capital city. They don't have even a standing army or a defined territory. They're much, much, much weaker than the Plishtim, even Ammon and Moab and all the other enemies that Klal Yisrael fought in Sefer Shoftim, the Knanim, Aram Naharaim. They are not the strong military threat. And yet somehow they are who the Navi ultimately identifies as as Shaul's primary foe. We'll need to figure out why that is. The next major question, we'll start really three questions. The second question, and this is like just a super, super basic one. So we know we have a mitzvah to wipe out Amalek. But if we had to choose, let's coming out of Pesach, if we had to choose one nation, not knowing anything, that we would have thought the Torah would identify as the ultimate enemy of Klal Yisrael, for all time, this is such an evil nation, and we can never forgive what they did to us, that they have to be wiped out and opposed for all eternity, which nation would we have thought should be chosen?
Mitzrayim,
right? They enslaved us. They murdered our children. They denied God. Even after the Makos and Kriyas Yamsef in Sefer Yechezkel, it's the Haftorah for Parashas Va'era, hundreds of years later, Yechezkel still talks about Paro, who's setting himself up as a god. Ha'omer li yoriv ani asisini. I made the Nile River, right? The Paros claim themselves as divine even after the Makos and Kriyas Yamsef, and they enslave us, and they wipe out the children. They're cruel to Bnei Yisrael throughout the duration of Bias Rishon. And their ethics are terrible. Parashas Achrimos, where we read this Mincha Yom Kippur, where the Psukim identify Maaseh Eretz Mitzrayim as being the complete antithesis of how we're supposed to behave in the sexual realm. There's an Avera to go back to the land of Egypt. It's mentioned three times in the Chumash. You're not allowed to move back to Egypt. So there's such an overriding abhorrence for everything Mitzrayim stands for and everything they did to us throughout our history. And yet they're not the ones who we have a mitzvah to oppose for all time. If someone from Mitzrayim wants to convert, you know, three generations later and he's in. Why is it? What did Amalek do? What, because like one little battle they had? You know, at the end of Parashas Bishalach, where they fought us, okay? So the classic response, oh, it was after Kriyas Yamsuf and the rest of the world, you know, was like becoming sensitive to Hashem, and then they ruined the party. Like, is that really enough to you know, with the contrast with everything that the Mitzrim did? I mean, I was looking at the Abarbanel's Haggadah over Yantiv. And he's talking about the Makos. And he explains, like in detail, right? Each one of the 10 Makos, the Mida Kenege Mida. And he has no problem coming up with a list of 10 unbelievably horrible things that Egypt did to us when we were in Mitzrayim, for the punishments of the Makos to be Mida Kenege Mida. Truth is, if there had been 50 Makos, you know, which one view says there were, he could have come up with a list of 50 things that Mitzrayim did to us. Why are we highlighting Amalek as the unique foe of Klal Yisrael? That's the second, I think, main problem we need to think about. And for the third one,
can I say something? Sure, it's just, but with sure. Mitzrayim, with Mitzrayim, we still have Hakara Tatov, that they took us into the land and they allowed us to be there to the extent that we take off a little bit of wine during the Makos, during the recitation of the Makos. And Amalek was the one who provoked against us. They provoked they were the first nation to try to go after us after Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim.
Okay, so point definitely taken, but I still think that the contrast is one that's pretty glaring, right? Okay, so we have Hakaras HaTov that they originally took us into the country, but still, given, so then there shouldn't be any country that we have such a overwhelming opposition to. You know, I'm sure we could dig up, maybe not, but still, you know, ad kedei kach that you know we're gonna have such a vast gap. You know, was Mitzrayim hosting us enough to have this gap where, despite everything that they ever did, you know, long term we really have no lasting enmity towards Mitzrayim. Can't go back to the country, but they're still there. In contrast, I guess now by default, the answer is going to be that I'm right. While Amalek, you know, for all time, you have to wipe out every man, woman, and child. It's still pretty clear. And the last thing, which is not so clear, but very important, it comes from, let's show all my notes. It's originally a Gemara in Sanhedrin. I put the Rambam on the sheet because he's the easiest one to, he has it in the most succinct manner. The Rambam right here in the very beginning of the Laws of Kings, right? The very beginning of Hilchos Malachim. So what's the first thing the Rambam tells you? I would have thought the first thing the Rambam would tell me about the laws of a king is what a king is supposed to do. The Rambam tells you the first thing in the Hilchos Malachim, the Rambam tells you there's a mitzvah to set up a king, right? But he does not only tell you the mitzvah to put in it to establish a monarchy. Very, very interesting. Normally when the Rambam introduces an area of halacha, so it's very, very common for him to begin Hilchos Lulav by telling you there's a mitzvah to take a lulav. Hilchos Shofar, there's a mitzvah to take a shofar. You don't ever have in Hilchos Shofar, the Rambam telling you there's a mitzvah to take a shofar and there's a mitzvah to eat matzah on Pesach, right? That doesn't belong in Hilchos Shofar. Hilchos Karban Pesach, it begins with there's a mitzvah for Karban Pesach. The Rambam does not say at the beginning of Hilchos Karban Pesach, there's a mitzvah to bring a Karban Pesach on Pesach and a mitzvah to bring the Karban HaOmer the next day. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Karban Pesach. And yet, how does Ram introduce Hilchos Malachim? It's Gemara in Sanhedrin, but here's how he quotes. He begins: Shalosh mitzvos nistavu Yisrael b'shas kein nisas on the aretz. When we came into the land, we're given three mitzvos. Number one, limnos lehem melech. Number one is to appoint a king. Number two, lahachris zaro shel amalek, to wipe out the seed of Amalek. Number three, livnos beis habachira, to build the beis hamikdash. And the Rambam proceeds, and it's clear that those are supposed to be done in that order. So we need to understand, why are these three mitzvahs linked with each other? Setting up a monarchy, wiping out Amalek, and building a Beis HaMikdash. Why are they in this order? And why are they so connected to each other that the Rambam puts them together at the beginning of the Laws of Kings? Building a Beis HaMikdash, the Rambam has a section of Hilchos Beis HaBachira, which he begins by telling you there is a mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash. So why does he have to tell me in the Laws of Kings, in the very beginning of the Laws of Kings, about the mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash? He already mentioned it. It was not, it's not what we're talking about over here. Clearly, there is some very, very important aspect of monarchy that's related to wiping out Amalek and building a Beis HaMikdash. And we need to figure out what that is. So those are, I think, the three guiding questions for us as we begin to attack Perek Tezvav, where Shaul is going to go after Amalek. Number one, we need to be thinking, why is it that the Navi clearly sets up Amalek as kind of the hidden but ultimate enemy of Shaul, not the Plishtim, despite the fact that the Plishtim, from a military perspective, were an infinitely more dangerous threat. Problem number two, simply, why is Amalek so bad? Using Mitzrayim as kind of just the highlight to contrast it, but like, why are we so opposed? And number three, why is it specifically in the realm of monarchy that the role of Amalek and the importance of opposing Amalek is highlighted? To the degree that the Rambam even mentions it when he first starts telling you about the laws of a king. Okay. So when we think about Amalek, so I want to show this afternoon, I think that the easy way to do it is going to be to show where exactly their unique evil lies, and that's going to help unpack everything else. So we're going to see their unique evil in two areas which overlap. The first is going to be Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, and the second one is going to be Bein Adam L'Mako. So Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, right? Amalek's behavior, Amalek's treatment towards their fellow man. So there's one story in Tanakh which brings it home the most dramatically, and it's actually not how someone from Amalek treats a Jew. It's actually how Amalek treats a non-Jew that most dramatically brings home their cruelty towards fellow man in a unique manner. Let's flesh it out. It's source number two over here. This is Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, Parak Lamed. So Parak Lamed, that's the second to last parak of Sefer of Shmuel Aleph. This is going to be, this is David's parak, where David is chasing after the band from Amalek that burned his town and kidnapped his family and the family of all his men. So they're chasing after Amalek. And the Navi tells us in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayimtzu ish mitzri basadeh. So they're charging down into the Negev. So they're in the desert, and lying out there in the open field, they find an Egyptian man. So they give him bread and they give him water. He was lying out there in the desert. They give him bread and water. Then they give him some fruit, you know, give him some sugar, give the guy some energy. The Navi says, he revived. He had been, you know, he was passed out from heat stroke in the desert. What was he doing in the desert? What had happened? So Nabi says, he hadn't eaten or drunk for 3 days, 3 nights in the desert. You know, it's not going to be not good. Ve'amrlo David lemiyah, not medically advised. Ve'amrlo David lemiyata ve'emizata. Who do you belong to, and where are you from? What's your deal? Why are you by yourself in the middle of the desert? Vayomer, nar mitzri anochi, I'm a young Egyptian, okay? Eved le'ish amaliki. So here we have an Egyptian slave, right? This is like a reversal of the norm. We're used to thinking of the Egyptians as the masters, but here the Egyptian is the slave. Vayazveni adoni, my master abandoned me, ki chalisi, because I was sick, hayom shlosha, and I've been abandoned for 3 days. That's what we need to know. What is happening here? We have this person from Egypt who's enslaved to someone from Amalek, likely was captured in a raid, because that's what Amalek does, right? They live in the desert, and then they raid settled areas and enslave the people they capture. So he captured and enslaved this young Egyptian. This Egyptian slave was taken when they went north to invade David's camp. They're running back because they do hit and run raids. So they're running back to their home base, and the Amaleki's slave is sick. So he's slowing down the camp. So what does the Amalekite do? He doesn't carry his Mitzri slave with him. He doesn't load him up on a horse or something. He doesn't even kill him. He doesn't even give him a mercy death. He just abandons him in the middle of the desert to die a horrible death of thirst. If you have no benefit to me, then you are completely irrelevant. There's absolutely not an ounce of compassion. Zero. Right, if you don't have anything to offer me, then you don't even exist for Amalek. You only exist for me to exploit. And once there's nothing I can exploit from you, there's nothing left for me to do. I'm not even going to give you the mercy of. He's not even going to kill him. He's just going to drop him and let him die of thirst out in the desert. Now that ends up being the downfall for Amalek, because this Egyptian, right, then becomes the source of intelligence for David, because he tells David exactly where the base was. And really interestingly, you know, so in Pasuk Tezvav, David says to this Egyptian, you know, former slave, he says, okay, here's the deal. Can you tell me where they are? And what does the Egyptian say? He says, you know, swear to me in the name of God. Interesting, he says the name of God. This is an Egyptian. He doesn't say the name of Hashem, the generic term. When he says the name of Elohim, Yudke, not Yudke Vavke, but Elohim, keep that in mind. Im timiseni, right? If you don't kill me and you don't give me back to my master, im taski reini biyad adoni v'oridcha el hagadud hazeh. If you don't kill me and you don't give me back to my Amalekite master, I'll take you to their base. Now, what negotiating position is this Amalek, is this Mitzri Eved in? Right? He's got no food, he's got no water, he's by himself in the desert. And yet he's so horrified by the prospect of going back to his Amalekite master, that this has to be one of his conditions. He would rather die by himself in the desert than go back to the to his master from Amalek. So there is a unique cruelty and a unique matter of just absolute lack of human value, none whatsoever, that's exposed here in this one story. Right, this isn't just a lack of chesed. This is just a total indifference to human suffering for no gain whatsoever. So that's part one. We think of Amalek values or lack thereof. There's a second story, also later on in Sefer Shmuel, which helps expose, I think, something else that sets Amalek apart. You know, we think about who Amalek was. So Amalek, they were a desert tribe. They're not the only one. There are other desert tribes in the Middle East at the time. All of Yishmael, all of Avraham's other children, all of the sons of Keturah roam around in the desert. The way that Yishmael makes a living is not really much different from the way that Amalek makes a living. They don't farm. They don't trade. They raid and they steal and they capture and they murder. That's basically how Yishmael operates. That's not so different from Amalek. So, you know, it began by thinking what makes Amalek different from Mitzrayim in terms of how we treat them. But we can really ask, what makes Amalek different from the other tribes in the desert? We struggled mightily against the other tribes in the desert in Sefer Shoftim during the rule, the tenure of Gidon. The Navi there says that Midian's a nomadic desert tribe, along with the other desert tribes, the Navi even says, including Amalek happens to be. Amalek was recruited as one of Midian's allies. So they regularly raid and starve the people. But this is like a parallel civilization, the civilization of Midian. Now, at the end of the Gidon arc. So Gidon, remember we talked about this before Yantif. Gidon, remember he goes all the way out into the far Jordanian Syrian desert, chasing after the Midianite army. In contrast, remember, to Shaul, who was not able to inspire his troops to keep on going out there. But at the end, Gidon succeeds in capturing the two princes who led Midian. Gidon was going to let them live. Then Gidon finds out that they murdered his brothers. So now, since they murdered Gidon's brothers, Gidon's going to kill them. Okay. Pasuk Chaf over here, source number three, Gidon says to his oldest son to kill these two Midianite princes. The Navi says that Gidon's son was too afraid to kill them. These are impressive, fierce, mighty warriors. They're kings. They're wild desert chieftains. Even though they're captured, they're still intimidating. So Gidon's son doesn't want to do it. And then you have a very interesting line from the Midianite princes. Vayomer Zevach v'Tzalmunna, those are the two princes. Kum ata ufka banu. You should be the one to kill us. Ki ki'ish gvuraso. As is the man, so is his strength. What you have here really is the ancient classic desert code of honor. You know, the desert, who's going to kill the kings in the desert? It should be the other kings. There's a respect, king to king. You know, we, Gidon, you're the leader. We were the ones who killed your brothers. And now you're the leader. You should be the one to kill us. These people are murderers, but there's a certain code. There's a certain law of the desert that they have over here. Ki ish gevuresa. There's a recognition of a hierarchy. There's a certain respect for people in positions of leadership, which Gidon then promptly does. Okay, now you have the exact opposite of that behavior actually being done by someone from Amalek. You have this at the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel Beis, when David, after having come back from fighting Amalek, so the Navi describes how this person comes into the camp and his clothes are torn, he looks terrible, and he says what happened. He says, I saw Shaul at the battlefield, and Shaul was surrounded, and Shaul asked me, who am I? And I said, I'm from Amalek. And Shaul said, can you kill me? Because, you know, I'm in agony. And this person from Amalek, this Na'ar Amaleki, this young nobody from Amalek, has no problem, he says, getting up. He kills the king of Israel. He takes the crown off his head. He takes the bracelet from his arm, and he brings them to David. So you have, once again, this contrast. These are desert tribes, but the desert code of ki ish kegvur aso, there's a respect for a melech, for a chieftain, for a leader, that they should be at least on the same level. Amalek, king, whatever, not a problem. And what drives home that this is surprising is what the Navi had said in one parak earlier in Shmuel Aleph, which set the scene. Shaul realizes that he's going to die. He does not want to be captured. It's going to be a terrible chil Hashem if he's captured alive by the Plishtim. So he turns to his Nosei Kelim, he turns to his weapons bearer and tells him, says, kill me. The Navi says, V'lo ava Nosei Kelav ki arei me'od. Just like the son of Gidon was awed by these Midianite kings, the Shaul's weapons bearer, even at Shaul's lowest moment, Shaul retains a certain aura of awe and dignity that his Nosei Kelim cannot, he's terrified. He can't even imagine laying hands on the king of Israel. A feeling which this Na'ar Amaleki apparently has none of whatsoever. So there's no respect for fellow man. And even the Navi is like contrasting Amalek with Mitzrayim, because you thought that Mitzrayim was bad to its slaves. Look how bad Amalek is to its slaves. And then coming after that, well, you want to compare Amalek to the other desert tribes? Again, you can't compare. The desert tribes, look, they're bad. They murder, they steal, they do all that stuff for sure. But at least there's something, there's some code, there's some honor, there's some respect. Amalek, you have zero. So that's piece number one. I think it's very, very important for us to keep in mind. When it comes to between man and man, they just have no concept of respect whatsoever. They exclusively look at what they can exploit. Zero. The second part, and the second point to think about, is in the world of Bein Adam L'Makom. Now, you know, we don't have high expectations of the other civilizations in Tanakh of being loyal monotheists. You know, very few Sheva Mitzvos Bnei Noach fans running around in Eretz Kanaan. But at least we have religious civilizations, you know, for better or for worse. That Na'ar Mitzri who said, you know, swear in the name of God that you won't harm me, right? There's like, at least there is recognition of higher powers, something beyond the people who are there. But here in this table, just a list of nations whose gods are referenced in the Tanakh. I don't think it's a comprehensive list, but if you look at it, you'll basically see every single country that is neighboring Eretz, that Bnei Yisrael are coming in close contact with. To the south, you have Egypt. To the north, you have Aram. In the east, you have Ammon and Moab, Ashur, Lebanon, right? Sidon, Edom, Canaan, all around, all the nations of the Middle East, basically, were introduced to their gods are referenced in the Tanakh at some point. And there's one dramatic exception. One out of all the neighbors we have, there's one who's there's no reference to their gods ever at any point. Not in Sefer Shmos, not in Sefer Bamidbar, Devarim, Yoshua, Shmuel, Shoftim, Malachim, zero. And that is Amalek. We never are introduced to any Amaleki divinity whatsoever. They seem to have none. They worshipped nobody. Nobody. Halavai, they had a Avodah Zarah. They worshipped nothing. I didn't put the Gemara. The Gemara has reference to this because remember the Gemara Megillah about Haman says Haman put an idol on his chest. Why? So people would bow down to Haman as a god. Right? Haman looks at religion as something to exploit for his own kavod. Right? It's not like Paro, who you know they really thought that the Paros were gods. Who, you know, they convinced themselves they commanded the Nile River. Haman, it's a joke. It's something for him to utilize for people to have to give him more to give him more honor. This is a running theme from the word go. As soon as Amalek shows up in the Chumash, you have Sefer Dvarim where the Torah describes how you know they attacked us in the desert. But the way the Torah says it, number one, Lo Yirei Elokim, they did not fear God. Asher Karcha Baderech, and Rashi, anybody who's ever been in yeshiva during Parsha Zachar is going to hear a Musar Shmuz about this, because Rashi says, why does it mean Karcha Baderech? So Rashi says, Lashon Mikre, language of chance, right? That Amalek did not believe in any sort of divine providence whatsoever. Everything for them is a world of chance and happenstance. There's no higher value. There's no higher power. There's nothing. There's just what pleasure and benefit can I extract and exploit from those around me. And there's a very consistent pattern in really all of Tanakh. It begins with from Shmos already. Whenever Amalek appears, it is invariably associated with a disappearing of the divine presence. It's like you know, Hashem comes out, Amalek comes in. You'll see it right here. B'shalach. B'nei Yisrael say to Moshe, Ayesh Hashem b'karbenu im ayin? Is God among us or not? Right away, vayavo Amalek. We'll look in a couple minutes at the Netziv. The Netziv is going to ask what this pasuk means. How could the Jews, having just gone through, you know, Yetzias Mitzrayim, and there's like a cloud and a pillar of fire, how could they ask if Hashem is among them or not? What does that even mean? But they ask, they question the divine presence. Boom, vayavo Amalek. Not the first time, right? Sefer Bamidbar, right after the sin of the spies. So the Jews, of course, now having been told they're going to wander the desert for 38 years, they regret it. They want to go now straight into Eretz Yisrael. Moshe Rabbeinu tells them, don't even think about it. Don't go. Don't go. Ein Hashem bekir bachem. Hashem is not with you right now. Hashem's not here. Who's going to be there? If Hashem is out, Amalek is back. And look at the order that the two of them are in the pasuk. When Moshe tells Bnei Yisrael that if they invade Eretz Canaan, they're going to be pushed back. Canaan is much stronger than Amalek. They have cities, they have chariots, they have advanced civilization. From a military perspective, Canaan is a much bigger problem than Amalek. When the spies were spying out the land and they came back, they were not scared of Amalek. Right? They were scared of Canaan. And yet, Moshe puts Amalek first. Moshe says, first, Amalek is going to be against you. And only afterwards does he tell you about Canaan. Because the point is, right, Hashem is out, Amalek comes back. That's the whole underneath all of Megillah Esther. It's the Megillah of Hester Panim, where Hashem's presence is concealed. That's where Amalek comes out, and you have it at the end of Shaul's life as well, right before Shaul is killed. And we know, you know, even though you know, technically maybe Shaul is killed by the Plishtim, but really Shaul is killed by Amalek. And you have that the moment of truth, Vayishal Shaul b'Hashem, Velo Ano Hashem Gam Achlamos Gam Beurim Gam Benevim, Hashem disappears from Shaul, Mida Keneged Mida, for his failure with Amalek, and we're beginning to understand what's going on. Hashem pulls out, and Amalek comes in. It's a repeated theme. It's a civilization that worships no god. They recognize no higher power whatsoever. And their appearance and Hashem's withdrawal are consistently consistently linked. In fact, that's probably why when Shmuel, if you look at verse 11, when Shmuel, we know how the story is going to end in our parak. We know that Shmuel will be the one who ends up executing Agag, the king of Amalek. So the Navi makes clear that he does it, not just that Shmuel kills Agag, but look specifically, by Shasef Shmuel as Agag, Lifnei Hashem Ba'Gilgal. Shmuel realizes the religious element to this. He realizes that this has to be done, not just anywhere, but before Hashem at the site of the Mishkan. You know, we normally do not think of the Mishkan as an execution site. I mean, in fact, you're not allowed to execute someone who's on the Mizbeach, right? Iron weapons and bloodshed and a Mishkan, even a previously located Mishkan, are antithetical to each other. But Shmuel says this has to be the execution site because someone from Amalek, who's always associated with denying the existence of God and the disappearance of Hashem, he has to be killed specifically Lifnei Hashem. And you see David's constant reaction, right? So contrasting David, you know, how does David succeed against the Amalek? By Schazek David Bashem Elokav. It's mentioned a couple of times. David runs to the Urim Tum. David tries to bring Hashem back in. David takes faith, strength in his faith, right? He realizes he's Ribono Shel Olam to fight this battle. So that is the two, and they're related, the two consistent and related parts about Amalek. What sets Amalek apart? They recognize no value with their fellow man. And it's not a coincidence that it's basically the ancient atheists of the Middle East were the ones who recognized no higher power, no higher being, denied divinity. So they don't recognize any value to fellow man at all. They don't have any value system. It's just, what can I extract? What can I exploit? The last verse I put on the sheet, and I'll take a couple minutes afterwards to think about Shaul. But the Netziv in the Hamak Davar, so he has like an extended, like a running long commentary at the end of B'Shalach, where he drives home a lot of this theme, this idea that Amalek is uniquely opposed to the presence of Hashem, but in a specific manner, which is very helpful for us. And it's if the opening question, and it's a great one, right? Klal Yisrael at the end of B'Shalach. So how could they possibly ask Hayesh Hashem b'kirbein v'mayim? What does that even mean? You had the Makos, you had Yetzias Mitzrayim, you had the Mun for crying out loud. What do you mean you're asking if Hashem is with you or not? And it's Sivash, just look at the red beginning. Hadavar Pele, Ech Nistapu, Acharei Ro'am, Amud Eish Vanan. You saw the pillar of fire and smoke. And it might still be there. It probably is still there in the heart of the camp. And you're asking, is Hashem with us or not? You know, the Medrash talks about this. The Medrash compares this to a child who his father is taking him through the desert. So his father, to protect him from the snakes, so he carries his child on his shoulders. And then up there on his father's shoulders, the child says, oh, where's my daddy? I don't see my daddy. So the father says, okay, you don't see me? He puts him down on the ground and the snake comes along. The snake represents a mullah. But then Netziv asks, like, what does that even mean? How could they question the presence of Hashem? So then Netziv explains that the clients are asking a particular question. They're well aware that Hashem can intervene in particular supernatural moments in human history. We could have a moment of Mitzrayim. But they're aware that this is a temporary manner. I mean, they suffered for decades and decades in Egypt before the Makos came along. What they are worried about is what is the world going to be like once we're out of the Midbar and there is no Moshe Rabbeinu and there are no open Nisim? Can there be a world? Can there be a world in between? Can there be a world between what they seemed to experience in Egypt, which was total Hester Panim, and what they experienced at the end of Egypt, which was, you know, Yad Chazaka and Zroa Netuya? But that was only going to exist in the short term. Could there possibly be a long-term reality where they're living Ba'olam Hazeh and yet feeling and experiencing divine providence? Not against nature, but through nature. Can such a reality happen? Can such a human program exist? It says that is what B'nai Yisrael were questioning. Right? Okay, we can have a moment of crisis where Hashem gives us man, Hashem gives us water. can we bank, if we're going to sign up for Matan Torah, can we bank on a long-term existence under Hashem's natural hashgacha? He says, that's what they question. And he says, that is exactly what Amalek consistently opposed. Because that idea that there could be a force of providence, a force of hashgacha, is what Amalek was completely, completely denying. There is no higher being. There is no higher power. There's no higher authority. There is nothing. And it's, and the Nitziv explains, this, for example, is why Yoshua has to lead the army. Why does Moshe all of a sudden retire? Moshe has been leading the people by himself. Him and Aaron have been running the show from Parsha Shemos. All of a sudden, Amalek shows up, and Moshe's like, oh, okay, I'm out. I got to go up on the mountain. Yeshua's going to lead the army. Why? Oh, because Moshe had to daven. Okay, Moshe can't daven and lead the army. They're going to fight other battles. They're going to fight Sichon and Og. Moshe's going to daven. Moshe's going to lead the army. You know, David is going to fight wars. David will daven. David will fight. You can do that. When Yaakov fights Esav, right? Tefillah and Melchama, they go together. You can multitask. You can daven and fight at the same time. Why does Moshe have to pull out of the army? So the Nitziv explains, look, Ratza Moshe Rabbeinu Laharos LeYisrael, Koach Hashgachas Hashem Aleihem, Gam Deli Nesnigla. Battling Amalek has to be done without open miracles. It has to be done where Hashem is intervening not against nature, but through nature. Al Kain Sider Mechama Zoh B'derech HaTeva. This battle is going to be fought in a natural manner. And that can't be Moshe. Moshe is the man of the supernatural. That has to be Yehoshua, whose whole job is going to be to transition Klal Yisrael from the supernatural reality of the Midbar to the natural existence under Hashkacha that they're going to have once they go into Eretz Yisrael. And Siv goes on, explains like 15 different things having to do with Amalek. The point, though, for us, just to close, right? So I think we've gotten a handle on what set Amalek apart. What was uniquely noxious and problematic about their ideology? But now let's just come back to Sefer Shmuel and think about the world of monarchy, and ask, why is this such a problem for a Jewish king? And why does the Rambam have to tell me in the laws of Malachim that the mitzvah to set up a king, and a mitzvah to fight Amalek, and a mitzvah to set up the Beis HaBachir, to set up the Beis HaMikdash, and in that order? And I think the reason for all this is that what we've seen in Sefer Shmuel so far is that Klal Yisrael faced a fundamental choice. What is their world going to look like? There was the model that Shmuel wanted, which was direct rule from Ribbono Shel Olam. No human king whatsoever. We're under Hashem's direct leadership through the periodic human agency of Shoftim Nevi'im. Klal Yisrael didn't. That was the model from Moshe and onwards. Klal Yisrael don't want it. They've had enough. They want to transition towards a more natural reality. We want a king. We want to be like the other nations. And Shmuel has emphasized in return, okay, we can have that model. We can have a model where there's natural political leadership, a king who's going to raise an army, he's going to fight battles, he's going to raise taxes, he's going to set up a government. We can do that, so long as you still recognize what Hannah had set up at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, that ultimately it still is Hashem Tzavakos, and Hashem's relationship with you is no longer going to be through open miracles, but it's going to be through Hashgacha. You're going to have to daven, but ultimately you're still going to rely on the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the first battle that Shaul fought against Ammon, they recognized that. Right? It was Shaul leading the army, Shaul slaughtering that animal, bringing the people together, setting up the military plan, getting them to attack in the middle of the night, tremendous victory. And yet at the end of the day, Shaul realizes the victory was not thanks to his own military brilliance, but it was because of divine aid. So the whole program of Malchus is saying, look, we can have this reality. We can have a reality of living under a king who recognizes that he's living under Hashem, under Hashgacha. It's not open miracles anymore, but it's still living under divine providence. So if that's the model that you want, and that's the model that Klal Yisrael chose, that's the whole mission of the king. That's going to be the litmus test for whether the king succeeds or not. Can we set up a civilization where we're at peace, we're in our land, we have a king, but we still recognize that at the core of everything is the Ribbono Shel Olam. So that's why that's why you have the sequence of those three mitzvahs. You set up a king. We can understand the end. You have the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, right at the very core of everything, is where you have the actual place for the Hashras HaShechina. You have to set that up at the end. But the other step, which is pivotal, is to totally and completely oppose the force which stands against all this. And if we're going to have a system which is based on Malchus, and kingship means the relationship we have with Hashem is relationship of Teva and nature and Hashgacha, so then you must target the civilization that stands against all that. Right? In a world of Moshe, of open miracles, Amalek is not such a threat. This one little civilization that just denies everything about Hashem and denies any values, any value to human life, any life to Elohim, let alone Selam Elohim. They have no God. They never swear the name of a God. They have nothing. Okay, when it's open Mako season, that's not the world's biggest deal. But when we've transitioned to a different situation, we've transitioned to the world of Teva and Hashgacha, if you want to have that, then you're going to need to oppose Amalek with everything you've got. Because they are the direct antithesis. The system of Malchus that Shmuel wants. We're going to try, it's such a hard balance to strike. Where we're going to have a king and an army and everything. But you still need to realize that everything is ultimately from Hashem, even though you don't clearly see it, because it's not clear anymore. If you want to be able to pull that off, you can't have an Amalek next door, which is sitting and just denying everything. And not only can you have them next door, you can't be okay with them being around. Because if you're okay with them being around, then that means that to some degree, you buy into their ideology. To some degree, you buy into their ideology. That is going to be the haunting, haunting question for Shaul. Does Shaul, to some degree, buy into the world of Amalek? Maybe we'll close with that. So I think we've set the table. Right, we see what Amalek stands for, why they're a horrible, unique problem in general, but why they're such a threat to the system of kingship that we're trying to get off the ground here in Sefer Shmuel. So next week we'll come back into the Pesukim. We'll see where Shaul succeeds, where Shaul fails, and I'm definitely looking forward. Thanks for coming. Great to be back and looking forward.